Of the 119 butterfly species that live in the state of Iowa, more than a quarter are endangered or threatened. Today, butterflies of Iowa and the fragile future of these beautiful insects. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all love butterflies, and it's easy to take them for granted. But we see fewer butterflies with each passing year, and it's not just the monarchs that are disappearing. This hour, I'll talk with Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Later in the hour, Stephanie Shepherd of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources will join us as well. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Now that the sun is shining and the flowers are blooming, we'll also begin to see the occasional passing butterfly in our yards and gardens. But those butterflies have gotten to be more occasional. This hour, we're going to talk about the butterflies of Iowa and their fragile future. With me today is Nathan Brockman. He is entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens. Hello, Nathan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's great being here.
And Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is also with us today. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for coming in, even not on a Friday.
Is it? You mean it's not Friday? Tomorrow's
sorry.
Not the weekend?
Sorry to break that to you.
Okay.
Well, Nathan, I've been using this number, 119 butterfly species in the state of Iowa, but I know that's not a hard and fast number. How did you get to 119?
Yeah, I used to in a lot of my talks, I would do 116. And lately, or just recently, we changed it to 119 because as butterfly populations move, as we find things or they spread, it's really hard to lock down to a set number because, you know, we may see something one year, but not again, or it might be a transient species from south that blows north one year, and do you count it? Is it a breeding population? Is it a regular population you see here? So 119 is kind of the number I'm using right now. Other people probably have a different one.
Well, and for a lot of people, I think it might be surprising that we don't actually know how many species of butterflies are in Iowa at this point in our history.
Right. And it's funny because with insects as a whole, there's so much we don't know about them. Even our species here in Iowa, in the middle of the United States, you would think we'd have everything worked out. But there are some species of butterflies that as caterpillars, we're not actually sure what they're eating, you know, in the wild.
Wow. Now, the other number that I've been throwing around today is that a quarter of those species are either threatened or endangered, or at least of special interest. That seems like an enormous percentage.
So those are the official listed ones that you can find in the Iowa code. There's two endangered, five threatened, and the 25 species of concern. The Iowa Butterfly Working Group, which is a group of Iowans that are kind of working towards conservation, headed by the DNR, has a bit of a different number and actually more species on its list.
Well, and since we don't know that much about many of the species that live in the state of Iowa, is it possible that that number is even higher?
Sure, it is. And that's one of the things we need more information as to how well they're doing. And since insect populations as a whole fluctuate greatly from year to year from a variety of factors, it is hard to kind of get a hard set picture to how well a species is doing or not.
Is this a new situation? Have there been things changing that are putting butterflies at greater risk?
It's a continual situation. There's always things that are changing in the environment or practices that we do that affect them. So it's not that it's new. It's continual. And if we don't kind of keep an eye on it, then things can go to the point where we may, you know, lose a species in the state, which we know we have.
Well, as you know, Donald is a regular guest on Horticulture Day. And Donald, you and I have talked about a number of different butterfly species over the years. And of course, most recently, we've talked about the monarch butterfly, which has declined dramatically in recent years and is at its all-time population low ever since the population has been tracked. And Donald, that's a butterfly that people talk about a lot. It's a butterfly that people can recognize and people can know. Maybe it's our most charismatic butterfly in some ways. But do you think that we're spending too much time focusing on the monarch because it's the one that we know about?
I think Nathan and I will politely disagree on this one. We will agree to disagree. No, I think the monarch butterfly as the poster child, as the recognizable, charismatic icon of the entire group, is one that does generate sympathy. It's sort of the public relations piece of butterflies because people know what it is. Grade school kids are able to raise the butterfly, the monarch butterfly, in their classroom. They're able to witness the miracle of metamorphosis by watching a caterpillar turn into a beautiful butterfly. And it's so much easier for a teacher and for a classroom to observe metamorphosis happen in butterflies than it would be for something like dung beetles. So the monarch has lots of uses, and it's one that does generate a lot of attention. Now, other people think all the attention going to monarchs is not necessarily good for the other 118 species that have been found in the state. But anything that gets people talking about butterflies, anything that gets people talking about conservation, anything that gets people talking about habitat manipulation, your question to Nathan whether this is a recent development, the answer is clearly no. We have been manipulating the environment ever since the European settlers came out here, looked at the prairie and said, boy, that would grow a lot of corn. And they started tearing up the habitat that the original residents, the original butterflies, we're depending upon. So this is a long-term change that we're still witnessing.
Well, and of course, we can't go back in time and preserve the tall grass prairie that so many different butterflies live in and depend on for their livelihood, I guess. But let's talk about the things that we're doing right now that are putting these species at risk today. And one of those things, of course, is still habitat loss, right?
Habitat loss, habitat fragmentation, and particularly going back to our poster child, the monarch butterfly, the recent changes in agricultural production practices have further reduced the amount of milkweed that grows in fields and roadways and in grass waterways and so forth. And that reduction of milkweeds, the only food source for the monarch butterfly, is a fairly recent development. So that's one of the things that we're continuing to do. As we tear out CRP fields or as we reduce the habitat diversity because of more intensive farming, we may be also eliminating a food source for one of the other butterflies and things like that. Now, one of the things we're not doing, global climate change may also be doing this, and the severity of weather from wet springs to dry summers to droughts in Texas, all of these things mix together to the detriment of the butterflies.
Well, and Nathan, you just mentioned earlier that there's so much we don't know about a number of individual species of butterfly. These kind of practices could be also impacting host plants for other species, right?
Sure. And habitat management is the other piece. You know, we know that we need to manage these prairie habitats or the plant communities will change and they'll no longer be prairie on their own.
Right. And so these are reconstructed prairies or there are a few remnants of prairie in the state. But you're saying that actually what we are doing to manage these prairies might be impacting the butterflies that are depending on this habitat?
Exactly. So whether you're mowing, you're burning, you're grazing it, those affect the habitats. And burning is one of those semi-controversial ones. Burning is a good way to manage for plant communities. But if you burn everything every year, that's not good for the insect populations. That's why now a lot of the recommendations are to only burn small patches and within a habitat to identify the different habitat structures, the plant communities, so that you don't actually burn one whole plant community at one time, that you take small chunks so that there's always some refuge for the species to survive and persist in and then repopulate the other area.
Well, and what is it that burning would be doing? I mean, burning usually takes place in the springtime. There would actually be butterflies, not necessarily in butterfly form, that have overwintered in that environment, right?
That's right. Butterflies, depending on which species you're talking about, overwinter in a variety of different ways. They may overwinter as eggs, as larvae, as pupa, or again, there are some in Iowa that overwinter as adults. And those individuals, especially the eggs, larvae, and pupa, can't run from fire. So if you burn every inch of a habitat, you're going to destroy those individuals. They won't be able to survive.
What about pesticide use in Iowa, in farming practices, on our lawns? Is this a threat to butterfly species?
Sure. Pesticides are designed to kill insects. And while they're used to target, you know, specific pests on crops especially, if it does get to other habitat areas near those crops or there's drift, they can definitely affect butterfly populations as caterpillars or as adults, depending on what type of pesticides and its mode of action.
And to broaden that out, Nathan has mentioned specifically insecticides that might have an impact. What we're also learning are the fungicides, and in the case of the monarch butterflies, it's the herbicide choices. Mm-hmm. So when we say pesticide, we're talking about a huge umbrella term of lots of different types, and we're finding impacts from several of those, not just the insecticides that we may be using that we often talk about with pollinator conservation, but herbicide use, the use of Roundup on grasslands and prairies and in fields and where we're increasing that herbicide use can also have an impact.
And it sounds like you're saying there's a lot about it that we don't know in that category as well.
As we look across the variety of species, yes, we tend to know a lot about a little bit of a small portion of the butterflies that are out there. We understand monarch butterflies pretty well, but when you get to other things, even the swallowtails, we probably mostly understand those. But there are other butterflies that we just have these knowledge gaps yet that we're still trying to figure out. Part of the reason, of course, is butterflies are beautiful. They're the jewels of the air. We love them for lots of different reasons. But we don't make money off of them, and we don't lose money to them. And when it's not an economic insect, it doesn't generate the research money. Basic science is a little harder to fund sometimes. The number of people willing to spend a career, spend a year or two studying butterflies is a pretty small number of entomologists. Lots of dedicated enthusiasts are helping us gather this information, but it's still a fairly small number of people who are butterfly specialists who can answer these questions for us.
Well, and we will talk about some of those dedicated enthusiasts a little bit more in a little while. Nathan, I know that you are working hard to take advantage of that resource, right?
Yes. One of the programs we've got running out of Ryman Gardens here at Iowa State University is the Iowa Butterfly Survey Network. And what we're doing is, it's actually been around for 7 years, but it's been a small program because I was missing a database portion that allowed people to enter in their butterfly sightings, essentially remotely from home. But what I'm doing is training individuals across the state to go out in the field and survey habitats for butterfly populations year after year so that we can track changes, identify when species drop down, and how butterflies are doing over time.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We need to take a short break. We'll be back with Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's butterflies. We have 119 butterfly species in the state of Iowa. Many of those species are endangered or threatened or of special concern. In this hour, we're talking about what we know about butterflies, what we don't know about butterflies, and efforts to learn more and protect these delicate insects. With me is Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is also here. And Nathan, just before the break, we started talking about your Iowa Butterfly Survey Network, which is an opportunity for people who aren't trained entomologists to get involved in learning more about butterfly species. How do people get involved?
So each year, right now, we just have trainings at Ryman Gardens. Our hope is next year to expand out and have more satellite locations where the training will take place. But in the springtime, we have a training. Individuals come in, they learn about the protocol, that they'll be going out a minimum of 6 times a year, walking a site for 30 minutes to up to 2 hours, and then just counting what species of butterflies they find on the site. And that data then is really helpful for us to see trends and to identify potential problems.
How many people do you have involved right now?
So, again, I mentioned it's been a small program because we've been missing a big feature. You know, I was getting paper forms mailed to me and then putting them in Excel spreadsheets. But this last year, a group of different states that have these programs have come together, and we now have a basically an accessible nationwide online database that these different statewide programs can be entering into. We currently have, I believe it's 8 sites that were being surveyed. And this year at our training, we had 34 individuals come. So we'll be doubling the locations at least that we'll be surveying. And we're hoping to, again, double next year and eventually have people in all 99 counties out there each summer looking for butterflies.
You've also, working with students at Iowa State University, developed what you call a unified butterfly recorder. Tell me about that.
Yes, the unified butterfly recorder. It's an Android app currently, and I have a new group of computer engineers that are working on the Apple version, the iOS version. And what it does is allows people to use their smartphone, their tablet, to go out in the field and enter in their butterfly sightings into the app. And when they do that, it collects so much more information. So it'll actually GPS tag where they said they saw the butterfly. It allows them to take a picture of the butterfly and keep that record with the sighting. It takes the weather, a lot of extra information, which is better than just, you know, a little hash mark on a piece of paper. Now we can actually look more specifically as to where the butterflies are being found on a particular habitat and if over the course of a season they move.
So I can imagine that this would be something that you can use with your butterfly survey network. Is that something you're already implementing?
Yes. So not everyone has an Android device. So a lot of my participants this year were also trained on the paper form. But anyone that has an Android device, we're recommending they use it so that we can test it better and get more information. And we've also shown it to other professionals, amateurs, enthusiasts across the state and around the world. We have interest in the app from individuals in Europe, Netherlands, Germany. So they'll be using this app that was created here at Iowa State across the globe.
Wow. All right. Well, let's talk more about conservation efforts. And I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. Stephanie Shepherd is a wildlife diversity biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And we've talked a lot about butterflies in Iowa, what we don't know about them, efforts to gather more information about them. But of course, knowing that butterflies are at risk, there are things going on right now to protect these species. What kind of efforts is the DNR working on right now?
We have a number of things going on right now, and certainly we've been, you know, ramping up a lot of our interest in butterflies and pollinators in general. And a couple of the major projects going on is, for example, we have a Prairie Resource Center, which supplies goes out and harvests and then supplies all our native prairie seed to all our public lands across the state. And they've received a grant from the Monarch Joint Venture over the last 3 years to include more milkweed in their seed mixes, as well as a greater diversity of milkweed species, in order to try and help with some of the problems that the monarch butterfly seems to be having lately, which is certainly a high-profile issue that a lot of people have probably heard of. Sort of lower profile species, we're actually starting up a project this year that will be looking at Leonards and Atoe skippers. These are tiny little butterflies. I call them the bulldogs of the butterfly kingdom, because skippers just tend to be sort of stout and furry and sort of ferocious when you get them in a net. And these particular two species are on our threatened species list for the state, and they really specialize on remnant prairie, but particularly on dry remnant prairie, and are only found sort of on ridge tops out in the Lusk Hills or on goat prairies up in northeast Iowa. So very specific habitat needs, and we don't even necessarily understand why they have those specific habitat needs. They We normally think of with butterflies that their limiting factor is their host plant, the plant that they eat when they're caterpillars. And the host plant for both of these species is actually fairly common. It's a little blue stem or side oats grama, which are grass species that occur throughout prairies. So why are they limited to these really very specific habitats, these remnant prairie areas on ridgetops and stuff? So we'll have technicians out there collecting data on where these species are, trying to update our information on the status of them, as well as trying to figure out some stuff about their habitat.
Well, and I have to ask you to explain what you were just saying. You called them ferocious when they get in the net, and I cannot imagine a butterfly seeming to be ferocious. So what behavior are you observing that seems like it's ferocious?
Yeah, I should say ferocious for a butterfly. They get into a lot of butterflies, if you get them into a net, they just kind of flit around and, you know, whatever. The skippers, when you get them into a net, they buzz a little bit. You know, they're flapping their wings so hard and they're just really bouncing around the net and just really mad and want to get out of there, much more so than the other species. They just seem to have this very sort of tenacious attitude or something in the net. I really enjoy interacting with them.
Well, Nathan, let's talk a little bit about behavior right now. We'll get more into different species of butterflies. But since Stephanie brought it up, I mean, when I see butterflies flitting around, they're beautiful. Sometimes my children will chase them. I guess I don't see a lot of differences from species to species, but I guess I don't know what I'm looking for. Do you see a lot of behavioral differences between different kinds of butterflies?
Oh, sure. And lots of different insects have their own specific behaviors. One easy and fun one to talk about is the Red Admiral, which the males of the Red Admirals are extremely territorial. So you could be out for an evening walk and you'll see this butterfly kick off of a leaf or a piece of grass, and it'll come and it'll fly around you and it may even possibly land on you. And we're all looking at it saying, oh, it's so cute, a butterfly landed on me. How special is it? But really what's going on is that individual is so territorial that it's trying to say, get out of my territory, and actually shoo you away.
So that butterfly is attacking you?
Yeah, you know, again, as Stephanie prefaced, as a butterfly can't attack.
Donald, do you have anything to add on butterfly behavior?
Well, of course, their feeding behavior. Butterflies have different preferences, and that's one of the things you kind of learn that, oh, I need to look at a certain group of butterflies, and so I'll spend my time staring at thistle blooms, knowing that the thistle butterflies are going to be on that group of plants. And that's why when we talk about butterfly habitat, we talk about the diversity of plants, not only for the caterpillar food source, but also for the adult food source. So feeding is one of those things. And of course, the mystery of puddling is in this group as well. There are butterflies that you expect to see at a mud puddle. And the little blues, spring azure is one, and some others that it's this cluster of them. They're all together and they're all sitting on the mud puddle. And that's a behavior that is fairly, it's not ubiquitous among butterflies, but it's common to just a few groups.
Stephanie, I know that a few years ago you were involved in work with the regal fritillary, which is a butterfly native to Iowa that lives in prairie environments. And I know that you were involved in some work to reintroduce that species and into the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And this is a species that is in better shape now than it was a decade ago. What do we see with regal fritillaries today?
Yeah, regals are doing remarkably well, considering that, so we talk about, you know, host plant being a somewhat limiting factor. The regal fritillary caterpillar only eats a bird's foot or blue prairie violet, so little tiny violets that are very specific to remnant or native prairie. They don't occur elsewhere. It's not like the woodland violet that you kind of find everywhere or that you can have in your yard. And so when we think about regals, we think about them being in, remnant prairie areas. And they were quite rare, and because prairie is rare. But in the last few years, we've started to pick up on them. using reconstructed prairies, so prairies that have been planted. They may not be reproducing there, but they're at least using that as a resource for the adults feeding on nectar. And they're big butterflies, so they can travel decent distances and that kind of thing. And also, when you go to a remnant prairie these days, you are almost guaranteed to see regal fritillaries out there. Whereas in the past, I think it wasn't always a sure thing that you would find them. But if there's even a little patch of remnant prairie around, they're usually around, which is a really good sign.
Well, it sounds like we've done something right. What can we take away from the success of that species?
Well, I think it's just that, like I said, they've started to adapt or use reconstructed prairie, or at least we've noticed that. I don't know that we know for sure why they've expanded into those areas or what's going on there exactly. But, so I think it's important to realize that, building on remnant prairie habitats and planting more reconstructed prairie in areas, particularly in the vicinity of remnant prairie areas, is, I think, a big, has been a big boon for that species. It's also maybe an example, like I said, we don't necessarily know exactly what's going on with them, but, we have examples of other species, like the wild indigo duskywing, which is a state-listed species. A variant of that species has started, it normally eats wild indigo, which is a prairie plant, but a variant of that species has started eating crown vetch, the caterpillars have. So obviously crown vetch is a lot more common than wild indigo, and it's been able to expand quite a bit because of that. So they are adaptable creatures as long as we give them the time to be able to make those adaptations, and we don't, let their populations get so low that they can't sort of deal with changes.
This hour, we're talking about Iowa's butterflies and efforts to protect these delicate insects. With me right now is Stephanie Shepherd. She is a wildlife diversity biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Also, Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens, is here, along with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And Stephanie, before we let you go, when people listen to conversations like this, those of us that wish we could do something to help butterflies, we're listening to you talk about efforts of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, but from your perspective, what can an individual do that could benefit butterfly species?
Well, I think there's a lot of things, on one side of things, Nathan was talking about his citizen science project, the Butterfly Survey Network. A lot of stuff about butterflies is that we just don't know a lot about what's going on with them. So, volunteering to help with something like that, or just getting excited about butterflies, or encouraging your kids to learn more about butterflies so that we get more information to work with. On the other side of things, you may not necessarily be helping the rarest of species, but planting any kind of butterfly-friendly habitat in your yard is really key. Making sure to limit your use of pesticides, because any using pesticides to kill pest insects, it pretty much is broad scale will affect most insects. So, limiting your use of those things and planting some pollinator or butterfly friendly habitat is a really good thing. Even if you've just got a suburban backyard, you'll bring in a number of species and be rewarded by being able to watch them as well.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Shepherd is wildlife diversity biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And Nathan, I know that a lot of other organizations are getting on board and getting excited about helping citizens create some butterfly habitat in their yards. We see a lot of information about butterfly or pollinator gardens and different nature centers selling milkweed plugs, for example. I know that you've been working with Blank Park Zoo on a program. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. The Blank Park Zoo this spring rolled out a new program that they're calling Plant Grow Fly, which the website is just plantgrowfly.com, or you can go to the Blank Park Zoo website and they'll have a link to it on there. And what it does is encourages individuals, just like Stephanie mentioned, to go out and plant pollinator friendly, and this list is really butterfly friendly as well, host plants and nectar plants. So food for the caterpillars, because you can't have butterflies unless there's host plants for them to feed on as caterpillars, and then nectar sources for them to feed from as adults. And the hope is that people across Iowa will be doing this, and it'll increase the, you know, resources that are available for our butterflies to use, especially if they have to move from one habitat in Iowa to another habitat. They need these corridors or these little stops where they can get more nectar.
And if I plant a little plot in my backyard, and let's say I live in a subdivision where nobody else has this kind of habitat, does it really make a difference?
Every little bit can help. It's better if you can get your neighbors in on this as well, your whole community kind of focus, because the larger the habitats, the better. If you're one little house in a giant neighborhood and everyone else just has nothing but turf and they spray, you're essentially a tiny little island, and the chances of someone even finding you becomes quite difficult.
All right, so do it, but also spread the word.
That's right. Definitely spread the word.
Your advice. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll talk more about butterflies, individual butterfly species, how you can observe butterflies in Iowa. And we also want to hear your questions and your observations. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the butterflies of Iowa. 119 different species of butterfly live in this state. With me is Nathan Brockman. He's entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens. Also, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. You're welcome to join our conversation as well with your questions and your butterfly observations. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And now, earlier in the show, Donald, you and Nathan agreed to disagree about how much we should be talking about the monarch butterfly. Nathan, give me one of your favorite species that you think we should be talking more about.
Sure. And I don't like to say I have any favorites. It's like picking your favorite child. They're all special and unique in their own ways. And with butterflies, especially when you really get to looking at them, they have amazing traits and behaviors that make them special. So one that I already talked about, the Red Admiral, but I also like to talk a lot about the Regal Fritillary. And Stephanie talked about it some. But the part that I always like to emphasize is, here's an individual that in the fall, the females lay their eggs on a plant that isn't even there, because the bird's foot violet and the prairie violet that Stephanie talked about has senesced, and it's died back to the ground. And in this tall grass prairie, this regal fritillary female has to dive bob down to the ground. And it's quite a sight to see one of these individuals flying along and then just drop into the tall grass, climb down to the ground, and lay their eggs on the soil or in the leaf litter that's down there. And then the caterpillars will eat their egg in late fall, early winter, nothing else, and will survive our Iowa winter down in the leaf litter as a first instar caterpillar, which are tiny, tiny little individuals.
And until even this horrific winter that we all just survived.
Even this horrific winter. And actually, snow cover is better for them because it covers them up and actually keeps them a little warmer. But then they don't get their first plant to eat until spring, when the bird's foot violet and prairie violet finally comes up out of the ground. So, yes, the monarchs make this amazing migration, and they're not the only migrating species. The Painted Lady, the Red Admiral, are also a couple other examples of individuals that have to migrate back into the state, for the most part, each year.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that there are actually butterflies that overwinter as adults.
Yes. So an overwintering individual example would be things like the mourning cloak, the question mark, the comma. So they're oftentimes one of the first butterflies you'll see in the spring. And even in the middle of winter, if it's a nice, bright, sunny day, and let's say and I don't know the exact number, but their body temperature with the help of the sun can warm up to, say, 65 degrees, those individuals will then fly around for a bit and then settle back down and, you know, kind of go back into their winter diapause.
Yeah. I've never seen a butterfly in the wintertime. Have you come across one in the wild that has just awakened for the day?
Well, I have seen on really nice days with a little bit of snow on the ground, morning cloaks fly around, and I've also found them sitting. And, you know, in my position at Ryman Gardens, I get a lot of phone calls of individuals who have wood piles and they're bringing wood in each year. And all of a sudden they'll be like, I have this butterfly in my house. What do I do and where did it come from?
And typically they're bringing it in.
Well, in some cases they're so far away that, you know, I just say, well, enjoy it or put it back outside. The hope is it's a species that can go back out like a morning cloak. But if they accidentally brought in, say, a pupa and the pupa emerged of something of like a black swallowtail, unfortunately that individual can't handle being put back outside. And I just, you know, tell them how to feed them, care for them for, you know, their time as an adult until they finally die because it's the wrong time of the year for them.
Well, and Donald, I know the morning cloak was one of the species that you wanted to talk about today, and Nathan just stole your thunder there a little bit, but was there anything else you wanted to
Sorry.
Add?
Oh, as I think of butterflies that have some special significance to me, the morning cloak is one that's on my list. And because of this different behavior of spending the winter in the adult stage, one of the things people try to do to help butterflies is they put up a butterfly house. They put up what is supposed to be a little place for butterflies to hibernate. And Nathan has given you the list of the three species of butterflies that might potentially use a house for hibernation, a butterfly house in the garden, for hibernation during the winter. So we're really not helping the butterflies with a butterfly house, but I always encourage people to put up butterfly houses as a visible sign that says, I care about butterflies and they are welcome here.
It's but just a little self-esteem boost for any passing butterfly.
That's right. Or a note to your neighbor that says, look, I think about butterflies and I hope you do too. But morning cloaks that come out of the winter are faded. They're tattered. Maybe it's because of my advanced age that I take a little more sympathy on those old butterflies, because these are old butterflies. Nathan talked about butterflies that emerge in the house off the season, and you may get 10 days of 2 weeks of adult life that butterfly is going to live. But yet the monarchs that migrate live much longer than that, and these morning cloaks that appear in the fall of the year are the same butterflies we see in the fall or the following spring. Huh. So they're quite old. They are the senior citizens of the butterfly world, and maybe that's why I related to them.
Let's get to the phones. And again, you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Carol's on the line in Guttenberg. Hello, Carol.
Oh, hello, Charity. Thanks so much. I love this program. I'm a beekeeper, and one of my bee yards is situated right in the middle of this huge, huge patch of milkweed. And I get this delicious honey from that yard, and that's kind of an aside, but I'm intending to send a sample of that honey to Texas A&M University. There's a guy who's a palynologist, and he can look at the pollen in that honey and tell me whether there might be some milkweed honey there. But I don't know if this is a remnant prairie or what it is, but I'm near North Buena Vista, Iowa. The farm, I don't own that property, but the farm that it's on has this patch of what I would call remnant prairie.
Those are great to have, and someone looking after them, preserving them, someone who says, let's leave this as it is for the benefit of the prairie, for the benefit of the insects that are out there to propagate those plants. Those are all great things. And as Stephanie mentioned earlier, prairie conservation and prairie management are going to be more important as we move forward with less of it.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. And Bill in Sac City also has a bee question related to this. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you to Donald and Nathan. So two of my wildlife areas have mostly restored prairie, but 24 acres of the 400 acres is a prairie remnant, and both have a diverse mix of flowers and grasses. And I've given a beekeeper permission to use the areas. Will the bees adversely affect the native pollinators, such as the butterflies?
No, and actually sometimes they say that it helps a little bit because the different groups stir each other up a little. So as you get one that might be hogging a flower, here comes another individual that wants to get in on those same flowers. And it kind of stirs them up and actually increases your pollination as you have this diverse group of individuals running around bumping into each other, essentially.
Good. Well, thank you.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot for your call. So the more ferocious butterflies don't
those
don't
skippers
put the
are
bees
ornery. Stephanie was not kidding about that. They when you watch them fly, they have a very aggressive flight. They know where they're going and they zip there.
All right. Sherry is on the line in Ely next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. My question is about herbicide drift. I have a small prairie plot. It's about an acre of reconstructed prairie. And I've had it for about 13 years, and I have a very difficult time growing milkweed, and also especially butterfly milkweed. And even the common milkweed doesn't seem to grow very well there. It sometimes comes out, and then it starts to turn yellow. And the prairie has bordered on two sides by farmland. Are the herbicides directly affecting milkweed plants?
Oh, that's going to be a hard one to give a definite answer to. The answer that I came up with as you were asking the question was probably not. It's not going to be doing any good, but to kill a milkweed with herbicide takes a pretty direct hit, but it can be done, and obviously it's easy earlier in the season. But this is also a chance for us to mention the Sensitive Crop Registry run by the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, where beekeepers and grape growers and others are registering online with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship that they have an area that needs to be protected from herbicide application and herbicide drift. And the Sensitive Crop Registry is one way to notify farmers around you to take extra caution, to check wind speeds very carefully before applying in the area, to eliminate what is probably a small risk, but it would be good if we could eliminate risk entirely.
Sherry, thank you so much for your call. And we have another question. This is from Carol in Des Moines, and it relates to something we were talking about earlier. A lot of people want to do something to help, and there are a lot of different kinds of plants that you can plant for butterflies. What kind of research should you do? What kind of garden should you plant? How do you know what you should plant?
There are a couple of resources that come to my mind, and I'll jump in and then let Nathan give the right answer. There's a group called the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S, Xerces. They used to be butterfly conservation, but now they are invertebrate conservation. The Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S, the Xerces Society publishes lists of plants by region of the country. So you can go to their website, xerces.org. Xerces.com.
I think they have the .com as well.
Xerces.com. And look up recommended plants for pollinators and butterflies. And we are in what they call the Great Lakes region. And they list plants that they think you should plant in this area. The other group that does that I'm aware of is the Natural Resource Conservation Service out of the USDA. And they have lists of plants that they, as a federal bureaucracy, recommend for farmers and others who are interested in pollinator conservation and butterfly conservation. So Natural Resource Conservation Service and Xerces Society are two sources of information. What else, Nathan?
And let me just, I double-checked, and it's xerces.org. That is their site. So X-E-R-C-E-S.org.
So yes, both of those are great resources, and I definitely recommend the Xerces one. They even have some books now for home gardeners, for pollinator gardening, and for people that are doing more large-scale agricultural as far as pollinator gardening in their buffer strips. The Plant Grow Fly Network that I mentioned earlier also has plant lists on it that was assembled as a group with host plants and nectar plants, and is good for the Midwest here, has a lot of native stuff on it. We put some other things that aren't quite as native or not native at all, but are easy to find in garden centers, so that your urban gardeners can find plants that will do well, that'll flower a long time in their yard and provide some habitat or, you know, food for our butterflies.
And I see in the different garden stores, you'll get butterfly garden in a can, that kind of thing. What about those?
Sure. Those aren't specifically for our area often, and you might have some success growing things like that from seed. Can be difficult and take a lot of time. If you want something to be doing well and getting butterflies soon, you really need to go with some larger plants, plugs, things like that.
We all want immediate satisfaction, and putting out seeds is a long way from having flowers that the butterflies will visit. So if we can go with container plants, if we can go with plugs, we found that to be a much better way to establish pollinator resource floral provisioning strips at our horticulture research farms.
All right. Linda's on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Linda.
Hi. We have recently been able to purchase a back lot, which we're trying to turn into prairie. And in the fall, I found strange things on some of the plants that I've not been able to identify. They are what shaped somewhat like a cocoon might be, and they are sort of a honey color, a light honey color. In my natural book here, it looks like they might be something that the thread-waisted wasp or digger wasps or mud daubers build.
Where was this again? Was it attached to a plant?
Yes.
Okay, and how high off the ground?
At least a foot and a half.
Okay.
Did you happen to touch one? What was the texture like on it?
Oh, it's tough. In fact, I took one, and since they're still here, you know, after the winter, I took and tore it apart. It's really tough to do with just fingers.
Is it like dried foam, or is it more like a silk sack?
It's more like dried foam, I think.
Okay. Nathan and I are going to guess that you have an egg case of the praying mantis.
Oh, my goodness.
Those long 4-inch insects that you see in the fall of the year with the triangular-shaped head and the big prey-catching legs on the front, she lays her eggs in what is essentially a foamy mass that reminds me of the spray insulation in a foam that you get or in a can that when you're insulating your house, you put in this spray foam. And in that, she has mixed 100 or so of her eggs and put it on a stem, usually less than 3 feet off the ground, and she walked away to die, leaving those eggs to propagate and hatch the following spring if they survive the winter.
And this is a good thing, right?
Well, that would be, yes, it's a beneficial insect. The chances of them surviving this past winter in the northern part of the state were pretty slim. It's a southern insect that does much better down south, but it sounds to me like praying mantis egg case. So I would look that up in your next Google search.
All right, Linda.
Yeah.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. And we have just a minute left. I'm curious. A lot of kids get butterfly houses. There are a lot of companies that sell different cocoons that you can watch become butterflies. How do you feel about that? And is there a role in butterfly propagation for these fun experiences?
Yes, and there's definitely a role. It's a good educational piece. The one caveat that I have been starting to really push is not necessarily doing it with just the painted ladies, but looking more, and this goes to the classroom as well, using our native species that we have here as those examples. I mean, one of the reasons the monarchs get so much attention is because that's what you learn in school. It's monarchs or painted ladies. And what would it be like if we use some of these native butterflies that had local conservation needs and raised them in the classroom and raised them at home? And when you mentioned about citizen scientists and things people can do, individuals, just general individuals trying to raise and figure out what plants, with a little help and assistance, that these different butterflies, they can raise in their backyard is great information for us in the future.
Nathan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Nathan Brockman, entomologist and butterfly wing curator at Ryman Gardens, and Donald Lewis, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Charity. Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk or at Charity Nebbe. Also send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on the show, a conversation with folk singer Peter Yarrow. This is Talk of Iowa.
It will not harm you. It's only me pursuing something I'm not sure of. Across my dreams with nets of wonder,
I chase the bright elusive butterfly of love. You might have heard my footsteps echo softly in the distance through the canyons of your mind.